each today. Okay? Are we ready?
Yeah.
Alrighty then. Okay, let's get it going.
It's truly amazing the number of conditions that respond favorably to cannabis.
We're looking at an unexcelled wonder plant, herbal medicine that has no comparison.
It would appear that cannabis and hemp are one of the first plants that have been grown in agriculture. We came out of being hunters and gatherers about 10,000 years ago, and so that's at least the length of time that cannabis has been cultivated. Cannabis has long been known as a medicinal plant, as a medicinal product. The latest studies or the latest findings are a tomb in China in which the contents of the medicine bag of a medicine man were discovered, and one of the things that it contained was cannabis.
The tomb was carbon dated as almost 5,000 years old.
The conventional wisdom, which goes to the oral history of China, is that the Emperor Shan Nen wrote the first Chinese Materia Medica and that it contained cannabis. He is alleged to have written it in 2637 BC, which would be almost 5,000 years ago. The oldest known copy of that goes back to somewhere between 100 BC and 100 AD. The oldest actual written record of the use of cannabis as a medicine is found in the writings of the Indian, as in India, Ayurvedic medicine, in which that a piece of history is dated at somewhere between 1100 and 1700 BC. Cannabis is found in every major Materia Medica that has ever been written. That includes the Ebers Papyrus from Egypt. It includes the writing of Descartes, who was Nero's doctor. And his Materia Medica was used for over 1,000 years. And it was included in the United States Pharmacopeia from 1854 until 1941.
Marijuana has been a medicine for a lot longer than it hasn't been a medicine. Evidence suggests that it was used in northern China for either shamanistic purposes, religion, or healing. And the culture of cannabis as medicine moved across the world. India was very big in the use of marijuana, and it was from India that W.B. O'Shaughnessy, who worked for the British East Indies Company, picked up cannabis and brought it to the United Kingdom, where apparently it was Queen Victoria's favorite treatment for her menstrual cramps. Ultimately, it came to the U.S., and in the early part of the 20th century, most of the major drug companies in this country were actually producing cannabis medicines.
Up until the beginning of the 20th century, cannabis was probably the second or third most commonly used medicine in the world. Cannabis was found in patent medicines that were manufactured by such familiar names as Eli Lilly, Squibb, Merck, Park Davis, Smith Brothers, you know, the Smith Brothers cough drops. And it was available powdered, chopped, whole, and as tinctures.
It was only in 1937 when Congress enacted the Marijuana Tax Act that imposed a levy of $1 an ounce for the use of medical marijuana that was the beginning of the end for marijuana as a medicine in the United States. It was in 1942 that it was totally removed from the U.S. pharmacopoeia or the formulary. But up until 1942, physicians could still write prescriptions for cannabis. So, you know, marijuana hasn't been a medicine for 68 years in this country, but it has been a medicine in the world for 3,000 years.
There was the misconception that use of marijuana led to debauchery and physical violence. And for that reason, I guess the investigator, I guess we were probably more conservative than we are now, but that's hard to believe. So it was considered the way alcohol was considered back in the time of Prohibition. And so it was prohibited, all uses of marijuana, because it had been used medicinally as well as for recreationally. So all uses were declared illegal, and marijuana then was given the status of a Schedule 1 substance, which means a substance without any recognized, any demonstrable therapeutic effects, as opposed to cocaine, which was also declared illegal for recreational use, but it still had medicinal properties as a local anesthetic, for which it is used today, to this day. That's Schedule 2.
Thousands of cigarette butts litter our parks and beaches. Is Kauai an ashtray? Smokers, if you're in your car or at the beach, hang on to your butts. Protect ocean wildlife and keep Kauai clean. A reminder from the Surf Rider Foundation.
Fiorella LaGuardia, who was the mayor of New York, established an august body of scientists to investigate whether the claims that marijuana use was going to increase mental illness and crime in the United States were valid. And the LaGuardia Commission report was issued in 1942, and they concluded that marijuana was a good medicine and that the claims that its use would increase crime and mental illness were unsubstantiated.
Prohibition!
Cannabis and its impact on human health.
That sentiment was repeated in 1972 when the Nixon Marijuana Commission wrote their report. This was in the face of the admonition by President Nixon that they not recommend the legalization of cannabis for recreational use.
Oh, there is a commission that is supposed to make recommendations to me about this subject.
The recommendation of the commission in its first report is that we do not feel that private use or private possession in one's own home should have the stigma of criminalization, that people who experiment should not be criminalized for that particular behavior.
Every 10 years or so, our government has sponsored another look into marijuana as medicine. The last one actually now being 1999, when the Institute of Medicine did it. And every 10 years, these august bodies come up with the same conclusion, that there's medicinal value to marijuana and its adverse effects and addictive potential and gateway drugness are overstated. And for some reason, every 10 years, these reports go, I don't know if they're ignored, but they certainly don't seem to change policy.
In 1974, a fellow with glaucoma who was going blind named Robert Randall was arrested for possession of marijuana. He had found that using the marijuana had diminished the symptoms that he was having, and it was later found by both Johns Hopkins and the Jules Stein Eye Institute at UCLA that this was the only thing that would preserve his eyesight. And the federal government then agreed to provide Mr. Randall with marijuana for medical purposes. He had made an agreement, or the government thought he had made an agreement, not to tell anybody about this. Well, as soon as it happened, he told as many people as he could, and began to spread the word, and people began to apply for this program, which was called the IND program. At one time, there were as many as 15 Americans who were receiving 300 hand-rolled marijuana cigarettes a month from the federal government. And there were another 35 people who were approved for the program. In 1989, the first Bush administration decided that they needed to review this. They were concerned that too many people were applying for the program, and if too many people got on it, the public might get the, quote, wrong idea that marijuana actually had some medical value, which, of course, it actually does have some medical value. Just prior to that time, in 1988, the chief administrative law judge of the Food and Drug Administration issued a ruling recommending that marijuana be rescheduled from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. In his ruling, he found that marijuana was one of the safest therapeutic agents known to man, and he stated that it was safer than eating 10 potatoes. So I've always been very careful about the number of potatoes I've eaten since then.
Marijuana was widely used in the 19th century for the treatment of asthma. And in the 1970s, we found that marijuana has a bronchodilator effect. It's because of the THC in marijuana. First of all, let's contrast, or compare and contrast, marijuana with the other, even more widely smoked substance in our society, tobacco. The tobacco was used more widely than any other smoked substance, and marijuana is second only to tobacco.
Lucy?
Yes, dear?
Give me a cigarette, will you, hon?
Pause here for station identification. You're listening to KKCR and your community radio station. And this is the Kauai Island Hemp Show. And at the last half hour, I mean the last 15 minutes of the show, we're going to open up the lines. And you're free to call in and let your comments be known. Or you can ask questions. And this is an interesting, different, new way of doing radio, where I would like to engage the community into something that this is something that we can talk about, and you know, we can work together and come up with some solution to some problems. So, right back to the show. Here we go.
The major difference is that tobacco contains nicotine, not found in marijuana, and marijuana contains THC and about 60 other THC-like substances called cannabinoids, not found in tobacco. But there are a lot of other particulates that are shared in common, and these include carcinogens, such as benzpyrene, the most potent of the carcinogens, and considered to be responsible for a large percentage of human cancers. Benzpyrene is found in 50% higher concentration in marijuana smoke than in the smoke from a comparable quantity of tobacco. And this has been shown by three separate groups of chemical investigators. So the expectation is that if you smoke marijuana enough and on a regular basis, that you would incur similar risks to smoking tobacco. So what are the major health risks for tobacco? Emphysema, which I prefer to call chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, it's the new term, consists of chronic bronchitis and emphysema. But you could have significant impairment in lung function without emphysema. It could just be due to airways disease, what we call small airways disease. But because we can't separate out the two components of COPD, emphysema, and the airways component, we lump them together. So that's COPD. So now COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. and in the world, and will become the third leading cause in 2020. So it's a very important disease. About 120,000 Americans die each year from COPD. Probably the best evidence for separating out, the best method for separating out a COPD patient from someone else is to look at the rate of decline in lung function. Shouldn't say the best. It's probably the most informative. But it's more difficult to do because you have to make measurements every year for a number of years. And so you get a slope of the rate of loss of lung function over time. We did that. We actually measured lung function every year in our marijuana smokers up, up to 8 years. And we found that the slope of the decline in lung function was almost identical in the marijuana-only smokers compared to the non-smokers, where it was accelerated in the tobacco smokers. So just one other piece of evidence that marijuana is not a risk factor for the development of COPD. I think I'm convinced of that. And the other major health consequence, pulmonary health consequence of tobacco, is lung cancer. Cancer is the second most common cause of death in the U.S., and lung cancer is the most common form of cancer. And the major risk factor for lung cancer is tobacco smoking. About 160,000 Americans die each year of lung cancer. So the question that came to my mind and that of my colleagues was whether or not there was any evidence that marijuana would at least qualitatively share some of these health risks with those of tobacco. And that was the rationale for initiating our studies back in the 1980s. What is the evidence that marijuana smoking, habitual marijuana smoking, can lead to lung cancer? With respect to the development of lung cancer, we found no evidence of any increased risk of lung cancer occurrence in association with marijuana smoking alone. The marijuana smokers, if anything, had a reduced risk for developing lung cancer. Not a significantly reduced risk, but reduced less than a one-fold. So that means reduced. Whereas the tobacco smokers had a markedly increased risk. If those who smoked more than two packs a day had a 20-fold increase in the risk. That's 2,000%. Those who smoked from one to two packs a day had an 8-fold risk. 800%. So that contrasts with no risk, no increased risk, or any slightly reduced risk for the marijuana smokers. THC actually has an anti-tumoral effect. And these are studies that were done both in experimental animals and in cell culture systems, and for different kinds of cancer. For lung cancer, breast cancer, thyroid cancer, prostate cancer, gliomas, brain cancer, that the development and growth, or the growth actually of the tumor is suppressed by THC, and metastases are also suppressed. So how can that be? Well, THC impairs protein synthesis, and it's what we call anti-mitogenic or anti-proliferative. You need, so tumor cells don't as readily proliferate in the presence of THC. They're also anti-angiogenic, so they interfere with the growth and development of new blood vessels that are necessary for metastatic spread. And they also are pro-apoptotic. What is apoptosis? Apoptosis is programmed cell death. So when cells age, there is a mechanism whereby the cells die. It's a non-necrotic death to die off the old cells and we get rid of them before they have an opportunity to develop mutations that would lead to cancer. So enhancing apoptosis diminishes the risk of the cells becoming cancerous. So marijuana turns out, THC rather, turns out to be pro-apoptotic. So those appear to be the mechanisms that might account for these anti-tumoral effects of THC. We decided to do our own case-control study. Funding from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is a major funding agency for marijuana-related research. This was the largest study ever conducted on this subject. It was very well designed. We used the Los Angeles Tumor Registry to identify, rapidly ascertain, all the cases of lung cancer and head and neck cancer that were diagnosed in the L.A. County system. And, of course, by the time we got to some of them, they'd already died or were too sick. But we got to it, over 60% of them who agreed to participate and were able to participate. And we administered this questionnaire. And then we matched them to controls, same age, socioeconomic status, that lived in the same neighborhood, using an algorithm that USC developed for this purpose, so that we could match, we're comparing apples with apples. And then we administered this detailed questionnaire, at the food frequency questions, occupational history, all kinds of things. We also did molecular, we got a buccal smear so we could look at the DNA, we look at the genetics of lung cancer. So what we did was to recruit smokers, heavy smokers of marijuana, at least a joint a day for a week, and it ended up that the average smoker of marijuana whom we recruited smoked 3 joints a day for about 15 years. And that's true. We also required that they smoke that much for 5 years. But on the average, they smoked 3 joints for 15 years. So that's about 45 to 50 joint years. A joint year is the number of joints smoked times the number of years smoked. Over the study population was, I think, between 35 and 59. I think 35 was a younger age group. Because we thought that they had to be teenagers in their early 20s at the time of the, at least in the marijuana epidemic, which, you know, was in the mid-60s. So prior to that time, very few people used marijuana. But after that time, it just mushroomed up to 1979, which represented actually the apex, the acme of use of marijuana in our society. So that's why we chose those age limits. And so what did we find? For any category of cannabis use, including heavy use, we define as more than 10 joint years, but we looked at 20 joint years and 30 joint years. For every category of marijuana use, the ratio was less than 1, meaning reduced risk. It wasn't significantly reduced, but it was reduced. And the confidence intervals were not that wide around the point estimate. So there was no evidence. And we controlled for all the known or putative factors, for socioeconomic status, concomitant tobacco smoking, alcohol, etc. At the same time, when we did a similar analysis for the tobacco smokers, there was a huge effect of tobacco.
Okay, you're listening to the Quiet Island Hemp Show, and who's been speaking is Dr. Daniel Behrman, and he is a former director of the Haight-Ashbury Drug Treatment Center. And you're also been listening to Dr. Donald Trask, and he's a pulmonary professor at UCLA. And then there's a Dr. Donald Abrams, and he is the director of integrated oncology at the San Francisco General Hospital. And then the last speaker is going to be David Steiner. And David Steiner is a specialist in Oriental and Chinese medicine at UCLA Harvard. So we've got some really interesting folks for you, and I hope you're enjoying the show. We have the last 15 minutes of the show. We're going to have a call-in, and 826-7771. I'm interested in what your thoughts are, if you're interested in other subjects pertaining to this subject. I'd be happy to do the research and air some interesting facts. So we'd love to hear from you. So once again, that number is 826-7771. Okay.
Right. And we'll go back to the medical cannabis and its impact on human health cannabis documentary.
So I'm a cancer doctor, and every day I see patients with cancer who have nausea from their chemotherapy or their cancer, loss of appetite, pain, depression, insomnia. And my experience over the past 30 years of being an oncologist is that there's one medicine that I could recommend to patients that can take care of all of those problems. Instead of writing 5 different prescription drugs, all of which have side effects and addictive potential, I can tell my cancer patients to try marijuana to take care of any combination of those symptoms. The first study that I really wanted to do was in patients with the so-called AIDS wasting syndrome, which was something we saw before the availability of active antiretroviral drugs, and patients with HIV infection just wasted away. They lost weight, they got diarrhea and fevers, and dronabinol, Delta-9 THC, became available to help those patients increase their appetite. When we prescribed those patients dronabinol in the early 90s, they said, you know, this is okay, but I really prefer to smoke real cannabis because when you take cannabis by mouth, either as Delta-9 THC or eating, in fact, baked products, the absorption is very slow and variable. So it takes about 2.5 hours for a peak to be reached, and the peak level in the blood is quite low, and then it stays in the body for quite a long time as well. Also, when taken by mouth, the Delta-9 THC becomes converted by the liver to another psychoactive metabolite. So people that take dronabinol or eat cannabis baked products often get more zonk than people who smoke, because when you smoke, you don't get that second metabolite. Also, when you smoke, you get a very rapid peak in the blood in 2.5 minutes as opposed to 2.5 hours. So people can really control the onset of the activity and how long it lasts better if they're smoking rather than swallowing either a pill or eating a baked product. So our first study that we hope to do in the early 90s was to show that smoked cannabis was better than dronabinol in increasing appetite in patients with the AIDS wasting syndrome. I tried twice to get cannabis from the government, because they're the only legal source of marijuana for clinical trials. And both times I failed. I then went to Alan Leshner, who at the time was the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and he explained to me, in fact, that the government, NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has a congressional mandate only to study substances of abuse as substances of abuse. So my request to have marijuana, to study it as a potential therapeutic agent, could never be granted by the government, because, again, Congress says you can only study these substances as substances of abuse and not as treatments for disease. So in 1996, the terrain changed when we got HIV drugs that actually worked, and we didn't see the wasting syndrome anymore. But these drugs were broken down by the liver by the same pathway that metabolizes some illicit substances. And there was a report in the literature of a patient dying from an ecstasy overdose who was on one of the AIDS antiviral drugs who took ecstasy at the same time. So I said, a little light bulb went off. I said, maybe I should study to see if it's safe for patients on the AIDS antiretroviral drugs to smoke cannabis. And so I submitted that grant to the government, and that worked within their schema because I was looking to see if it was harmful. And with that application, I finally succeeded and got $1 million and 1,400 government cigarettes to study in patients with HIV. Now, these patients didn't have the wasting syndrome anymore, but the endpoint of our study was, is there a change in the amount of AIDS virus in the bloodstream after 21 days of exposure to either 3 government cigarettes a day or 3 dronabinol capsules or 3 placebo capsules? And so we looked at the change in the HIV virus, and it didn't change at all. We also looked at the interaction between the cannabinoids, either smoked or oral, and the amount of AIDS drug in the bloodstream, and that didn't change clinically significantly either. We also knew that people were concerned that marijuana might have an impact on the immune system that could be negative, and we looked at that very carefully in these HIV patients, and we found no evidence of any negative effect, and perhaps some evidence of benefit in the immune system in patients smoking even more than taking the capsules. In my opinion, the whole plant is the medicine that nature provided, and it's the best medicine.
It's truly amazing the number of conditions that respond favorably to cannabis. The number one condition is pain. Cannabis is useful in relieving people's pain. It's particularly effective in relieving pain from connective tissue disorders, from arthritis, from fibromyalgia, from systemic lupus, from reflex sympathetic dystrophy, a whole host of conditions that we don't really understand very well. People seem to get good relief from cannabis. People are able to decrease the amount of opiates that they're taking, and in some instances to stop taking opiates entirely for pain control. The first modern research that was done on cannabis was done in 1949 that demonstrated its usefulness in treating epilepsy. I have a number of people who don't have epilepsy when they use cannabis regularly. The founder of modern medicine is a physician named Sir William Osler, who was prominent around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. He wrote the first textbook of internal medicine, and in that textbook, he said that cannabis was the most effective medication for the treatment of migraine headaches. And I certainly have a number of people with migraines who get substantial relief or even prevention of their migraines by consumption of cannabis. Other conditions that commonly respond favorably to marijuana include depression. It helps people with sleep. It helps their appetite. It's also very good in treating GI symptoms, nausea, diarrhea. It's excellent for treating Crohn's disease. We did a little study of people with Crohn's disease and found that many of them were able to stop using steroids and stop using other medications that they had taken for their Crohn's, that they had less diarrhea, they had less abdominal pain. It was a true miracle for them. There's a list here of conditions that was originally developed by Dr. Todd McCarea, who was a pioneer in terms of medical marijuana. He actually worked for the National Institute of Mental Health, and his job was to give out grants for doing studies on cannabis. He thought he was there to find out how cannabis was useful to treat medical conditions. NIMH thought he was there to hand out grants to see how dangerous it was. This was a marriage made in hell, and he did not stay with the National Institute of Mental Health for very long. Cannabis is seen as a neuroprotective agent, and we have found that it has provided benefits for people with multiple sclerosis. It certainly treats their neuropathic pain and their muscle spasm, but more importantly, people who were placed on Sativex, the tincture of cannabis, in early studies in Great Britain have remained on it for years and years. And rather than progress, their multiple sclerosis has stayed the same, suggesting that cannabis may not only be effective in reducing the symptoms, but also in slowing the progression of disease. It's helpful in dealing with the anxiety of people that have Alzheimer's disease. It's helpful in dealing with the muscle spasms that are associated with Parkinson's disease. When it comes to psychological illnesses, cannabis is useful in not only treating depression, which I already mentioned, but also bipolar disorder, which is depression and mania. It's useful in treating attention deficit disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder. There was a study done at the Max Planck Institute in Germany a few years back that demonstrated it was useful in reducing fearful memories, so that might suggest why it is useful in alleviating PTSD. This is extremely important at this time when we have so many people who are serving multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon has projected that at least a third of these people, and I think that that is a very conservative estimate, will come back with the symptoms of PTSD. As a matter of fact, in regards to PTSD, both the Israeli government and the Croatian government have given their troops cannabis for treatment of PTSD. The list just goes on and on. Many, many conditions cause pain, serious conditions. Ankylosing spondylitis, which can actually turn you over, make you bend over in a crippled position. People who have failed back surgery, people who have herniated discs, people who have chronic dislocated shoulders. All of these people get relief from cannabis, and they find that the cannabis provides that relief with fewer side effects than the opiates do. Another thing that is sort of counterintuitive where cannabis is useful is in the treatment of asthma. You may have seen the ads for Advair that say it's both a bronchodilator and an anti-inflammatory. Well, so too is cannabis. This is why there were numerous marijuana cigarettes on the market in the 1920s for the treatment of asthma, specifically for the treatment of asthma. So, as I pointed out by holding up this list, the list of conditions for which cannabis is useful is extremely lengthy. That's a quick overview of some of the conditions that cannabis is useful in treating. Most people tend to take cannabis at least in the evening. Some people take it more often than that. And the reason is that many of these conditions interfere with sleep, and then there are some people who just have sleep problems, have insomnia difficulty, and cannabis is very useful in assisting people in going to sleep. Now, if they have difficulty staying asleep, in addition to smoking or vaporizing or using it sublingually, they should also use it as an edible or drink it, because it will kick in 45 minutes into their sleep, and it will be effective for about 5 to 6 hours. There are a number of different ways of administering cannabis, of getting it into the body. Smoking and vaporizing cause the chemicals to get into the body upstream of the liver. So you have unmetabolized cannabinoids that are going to the brain. Now, this doesn't mean that when the cannabinoids go through the liver that they are inactivated, but it means that they're different. 85% of the cannabinoid is metabolized on its first pass through the liver. The other thing is that when it goes to the brain immediately by the respiratory route of administration, the effect will be in 15 to 30 seconds. Whereas if we wait for it to go through the GI tract and through the liver, it will take 45 minutes before it's effective. Now, each one of those routes of administration is going to give you a slightly different mix of chemicals, because when you smoke it, you are oxygenating the cannabinoids and the other chemicals that are in there. So while you may be vaporizing the cannabinoids that are immediately behind where the flame is, you're also burning the cannabinoids that are right at the junction there. So that smoked marijuana is not identical to vaporized marijuana. With the vaporized marijuana, all of the volatile oils will be volatilized by the time you get to 340 degrees centigrade. And you will have removed or be exposed to about 70% fewer irritants than when you smoke it. It also has a somewhat different odor. It doesn't have the characteristic classic burnt rope odor, but it has more of a nutty odor. Now, when you eat marijuana, you're going to have metabolized 85% of the cannabinoids. People who eat it talk about having a body high as opposed to a mind high, and that is because you're being exposed to a different combination of cannabinoids. Now, some people have found that an under-the-tongue spray, which is what Sativex is, Sativex is an alcohol extract of the whole plant, which combines extracts from two plants, one that's high in THC for its therapeutic value, and the other that's high in CBD to keep down the euphoria, its anti-euphoria effect. And when you spray it under the tongue, it will be effective in about 15 minutes, but it will go to the brain first before going through the liver. On the other hand, there are many people in Canada where Sativex is legal that find that they still prefer cannabis to Sativex. Now, Sativex is prescribed in Canada, and it appears as though the British government and or the Spanish government may also approve Sativex in the near future for sale as a pharmaceutical in their country. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration found that Sativex, basically liquid marijuana, was safe enough to be tested on Americans, and they approved a Phase 3 clinical study. Phase 3 just means with human beings, in December of 2005, to determine whether or not this under-the-tongue tincture spray was useful in relieving intractable pain in people with cancer. This study did not get started until 2007 and is still ongoing. There have been numerous studies with cannabis and tincture cannabis and pain that have shown that it is useful in relieving pain. Now, We've talked about under the tongue, we've talked about smoking, we've talked about vaporization. There's also the synthetic Delta-9 THC can be taken orally, just like edibles can be taken. And the main problem with edibles is that it's hard to tell whether you're going to get a dose that is going to just deal with the therapeutic needs that you have, whether it's going to give you euphoria or whether it's going to give you dysphoria. And you need to have a regular supply so that you can be fairly certain that you're going to take an amount that will be the therapeutic dose and not an amount that will give you dysphoria as a side effect. Lastly, the curanderos, who are lay healers in southern Mexico and Central America, have used tincture of cannabis as part of their therapeutic armamentarium for at least 200 years. The topical application of tincture of cannabis is useful, particularly on the small joints, the fingers and toes, in dealing with pain associated with arthritis. And the reason for this is that cannabis is both an analgesic, a painkiller, and an anti-inflammatory. And we know this not only from the anecdotal evidence that we have, but also from thousands of studies that have been done around the world, mainly with animals and sometimes in tissue culture. The International Cannabinoid Research Society has been around for about 20 years, and they have conferences each year that last for 3 days in which researchers from all over the world talk about the results that they have gotten doing basic science studies. With any drug that a doctor is considering recommending or prescribing, they need to balance off the therapeutic effects with the side effects. When you talk about the treatment of pain, for many people, the opiates are very effective painkillers. But for some people, the opiates cause confusion. They make it difficult for them to concentrate, difficult for them to drive. They don't enjoy playing with their kids or their grandkids. It causes them constipation. With cannabis, for many of those people, they find that it certainly does not give them constipation and does not cause them confusion, provides them with sufficient relief from their pain that they can go about their activities of daily living, they can drive their car without interference, and more importantly, they can have fun. They can play with their children, they can play with their grandchildren. So I wouldn't necessarily say that across the board cannabis is to be used instead of opiates, but I would say that for many people it can be used instead of opiates, and for others it can be used in conjunction with opiates, and they can use a lower dose of the opiates and hopefully have fewer side effects. Now, any therapeutic agent that we know of has some side effects, and marijuana is no exception. The main side effect to the use of marijuana is from smoking it, and that's cough. So that can be completely avoided by eating it or drinking it, and it can be largely avoided by vaporizing. One of the things that's talked about a lot is that you can have a panic reaction, and that is certainly possible. It most commonly occurs in people who are novice users, particularly if they've been exposed to a plant that is very high in THC. Another thing that people sometimes have is paranoid thinking that the police are after them. I've noticed that this is not nearly as common since it's become legal, because the police aren't after them. And so it may not be paranoia that people were experiencing, but an exaggerated perception of reality. And one of the things that we've lost as a result of the propaganda and misinformation that has been spread about cannabis is the fact that it has legitimate therapeutic value, and we have discouraged research. We have dramatically discouraged research in this country and numerous other countries, including England, Israel, Spain, and Germany, are far ahead of us in terms of the quantity of research that they're doing on the medicinal value of cannabis. And this is particularly alarming in these economic times, when we certainly could use the economic stimulus, the economic boost that would come from having pharmaceutical cannabis available in this country, as it is now in Canada, and as it possibly soon will be in England and Spain. Jefferson said that This country would be in dire straits if we had laws that interfered with what we put into our own bodies. Are we not in control of our own bodies?
That's it. I think that's it. Do you want to read that?
Yeah, so here we go. Here's a Thomas Jefferson quote right here. If people let the government decide what foods they eat, oh, this is what he just said, that medicine they take, their bodies will soon be in a sorry state, as are the souls of those who live under tyranny. Thomas Jefferson.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah. And then you said there was a George Washington quote coming from the medical cannabis and its impact on human health, a cannabis documentary. George Washington has a quote, make the most you can of the Indian hemp seed and sow it everywhere. Some good advice from our George Washington. Richard Fernandez is in the house. He'll be coming up in 11 minutes or so. So, who was that? I want to give credits to the folks.
To the speakers, yeah. That was Dr. David Behrman, and he's the former director of the Haight-Ashbury Drug Treatment Center in San Francisco. And then you were listening to Dr. Truskin, and he's a pulmonary professor at UCLA. And there was Dr. Donald Abrams, and he's the director of oncology from the San Francisco General Hospital. And then there was Robert Steiner, and he is an Oriental and Chinese medicine professor at UCLA at Harvard.
All right. I learned all kinds of information on that.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting, and I hope our listeners did too. We are opening up the phone lines. That number is 826-7771. And we're interested in you if you have any additional information or any comments. Or I'm also looking for subjects. So if there's a subject that you would like to talk about under the marijuana, cannabis category, I would be happy to do that for you. I also wanted to mention that if you look up Hawaiian cannabis, Hawaiian marijuana use in your if you're looking that up online, and you're going to come up with a phone number, a state phone number, and I'm going to give you the phone number. Y'all, would you want to give me that back to me? That phone number is 808-733-2177. And when you call that number, you're not going to get an answer. I've called that number. I called the Kauai number. I called the state, the number in Oahu, and there is nobody answering that phone. So no matter what I did, I couldn't get someone to answer the phone. And so I finally got a secretary, and she called the number and for me, and I got in. And all it is if you want information about one thing, press A, press 2 if you want information about this, that, and the other, but there's no real person to talk to. There's no information available. And one of the things that was concerning to me was that so many people on Kauai don't have computers. So if they want to sign up as a patient, or they want information about a dispensary or dispensary information, they're just not going to get that. They're not going to get anybody to talk to. So.
No humans whatsoever. So it's not a very informative website.
Not web friendly. Not informational friendly. People friendly.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. So did you want to mention something about?
Oh well, I just wanted to point out the if you go to KKCR archives on December 28th, the Hemp Show, they interviewed Dr. Baco from HawaiiCompassionateCare.com, and he also talks about the benefits of medical marijuana, and he's here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I certainly hope you enjoy the show, and if you have any comments, you're welcome to call 826-7771. We'd like to hear what you have to say or answer your questions or whatever. I think we've got a caller right now. Okay. Okay. Hello, caller.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in India. I was around quite a bit of kief, bhang, whatever you want to call it, marijuana, boo, etc. And I didn't use any of it myself until I was into my early 20s. And I discovered that as I used it about once a week or so, not very seriously, but, you know, just for diversion and for socializing, I discovered over time that it decreased my motivation and it decreased my incentive in general. And at first, I was riding a motorcycle in New York, and I discovered that if I had smoked, that reality was definitely distorted. I thought that that I was driving on hilly, you know, rapidly hilly road when it was a completely flat road, etc., etc. And later on, I started growing it, and I developed a strain that was extremely potent, and it actually was psychedelic. And I called it strictly one toke. And when people didn't believe me, they were on the floor lying around in sort of a... Anyway, I wanted to get to my main story, which was I was up in Laos, and somebody had made some pot brownies. Obviously, the pot is very cheap up there, and you can buy huge quantities for practically nothing. He invited a few friends over, and he ate a brownie, and then he ate a couple more because he didn't feel that there was any effect coming in. And within an hour or two, he was in a total psychotic state. He had all kinds of hallucinations and a lot of paranoia. We took him to the hospital, and we explained to the doctor, keef, bong, pot, marijuana, you know, all these different words. He didn't understand. He spoke French. I spoke some French. And so they tried to get his blood pressure. He was on a gurney, and they thought, the guy thought that the doctors were taking his arms off. So I met the poor guy about a week and a half later in Bangkok, and his nerves were still totally fried. He was, I don't know if he ever recovered, but at that point he was seriously psychically injured.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I understand it, and I think that the doctors were real clear with what happens. It takes about 2.5 hours for the medicine to work when you eat it, and it's a danger because people don't know.
Right.
They don't think that they're, and so it's really easy to overdose. And it sounds like, you know, you can overdose on marijuana, you can overdose on any prescription drugs or non-prescription
drugs,
you know.
Yeah,
so.
And I want to continue because
we have about 30 seconds. I just want to give you a little heads up because we want to move into Sunset Jazz with Richard Fernandez.
Go ahead.
Okay, I developed a technique of emotional clearing, and I had several hundred clients over about 20 years, and I discovered that if somebody was a pot smoker, that they simply did not have the inner clarity or inner vision to deal with this work. They were sort of numb inside from all the pot smoking. And I also learned that the pot induces the natural neurotransmitters, the highs, obviously. The highs were used up. It's not actually the pot that makes you high. It's your own beneficial neurotransmitters, neuropeptides. And then you use those up, and that's why you feel flat and why you don't have any dreams if you're a smoker. and also why you don't have the vision to do this kind of inner work. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
we're going to have to cut this short. But you know what? I would really like to spend more time talking with you.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to off air leave your phone number, and I would like to get more information.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Just
hang on.
Stick around, then. Don't
hang up.
Yeah. So stick around. Hold on. And so that ends this month of the
Kauai Island Hamster.
There you go. And we'll be back next third Monday of February. So.
Okay, be well and take care. And I hope to run into you another time on this station next week. No, next month.
Next month.
Okay, bye.
Bye now.
You are listening to KKCR Hanalei and KAQA Kilauea. That's 90.9 on the North Shore, 91.9 island-wide. In Anahola and Molawa'a, we're at 92.7. And if you're on Oahu, you can still catch us at 104.7. We also are streaming 24/7 on the internet at kkcr.org. That's Kauai Community Radio, listener-supported and volunteer-powered. My name is Richard. This is the Sunset Jazz Program. I'll be here for the next 2 hours playing jazz music for you. But Sunset Jazz is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kauai Marine and Mower.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda Garden and Lawn Equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
And mahalo to Kauai Marine and Mower for supporting Kauai Community Radio and this radio program. I want to start off with mentioning that today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, And Martin Luther King did have a did inspire a lot of music in the jazz genre and in music in general in the 60s, music that we hadn't heard in quite a while, music of protest, music of yearning for something, music of wanting equality, and I think we still hear those same messages. So we're going to, for the first hour or so, we're going to be playing some music inspired by the movement and also Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Last part of the show, we're going to play a little tribute to KKCR's main patron and a friend of Kauai, Mr. Glenn Fry, who passed away today in New York City. I lived out in Hyena, was a friend to many, many people, helped many, many people here on Kauai, and we'll be playing a couple of his tracks later on in the show. But first off, we're going to start off with Mr. Lee Morgan from a tune called Search for the New Land that was written in 1963 and recorded in early 1964, that a piece that he put together that reflected what he